It's not simply enough to say, well, okay, we can trust President-elect Biden to do the right thing. If he really wants to do the right thing, he has to actually dismantle the machinery.
Yo, what's up? Welcome to In the Thick, a podcast about politics, race, and culture. From a POC perspective, I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Joining us is a special guest all the way from Brooklyn. It's Alina Das. She's an immigrant rights lawyer, professor at New York University School of Law, and co-director of the oh-so-important NYU Immigrant Rights Clinic. Alina, welcome to In the Thick.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are the author of the recent book, No Justice in the Shadows. Which is what we've been saying, you know, if people in the shadows is not a good thing for democracy. And your book, you write that roughly 300,000 people are formally deported from the U.S. every year, with a million more turned back just, you know, within the border area. You talk about how the immigration, criminalization, and deportation systems are intertwined in a desire to maintain the racial status quo. In other words, the white supremacy and white majority of this country.
Yeah.
You talk about how the use of the terms like criminal alien, one of our favorites, falsely separates immigrant communities into categories of good versus bad.
Right. And we've also had this presidential election where one candidate didn't denounce white supremacists. And in this midst of a nationwide protest for Black lives and a pandemic that has disproportionately affected Black and brown communities following the election, right? It was declared that Joe Biden had won.
Right.
Donald Trump, who previously had said he wouldn't commit to a peaceful transfer, refused to concede, and his allies started referring to votes as, what a surprise, quote, legal or illegal. And they especially tried to discredit the vote counting in cities with large Black populations, Detroit, Philadelphia, Atlanta. This idea of like even votes now becoming good and bad, legal and illegal, criminal or non-criminal. It just permeates throughout our entire electoral politics. So, Alina, can you talk about how the immigration system has been set up to protect a particular type of immigrant?
Absolutely. And this is one of the things I focus on in the book, is really a historical perspective, because we're told that our country is a welcoming country and that people who face deportation must be facing this because they've broken the law or they violated the laws, where the laws are actually written and the foundation of the laws are designed to treat immigrants as suspects, to exclude them and to exploit them. And we know this from the very origins of this country, right? The first naturalization law that Congress wrote, because the Constitution required them to come up with a universal naturalization law, was limited to free white persons. That's the foundation of our rules about membership and belonging.
Right.
And we policed migration in this country initially focused on Black people and Indigenous people, right? So for the first century, when voluntary immigration was mostly white, Congress was focused on fugitive slave laws that allowed Black people to be removed from free states to slaveholding states, and the Indian Removal Act that allowed Indigenous people to be removed from their ancestral lands to make room for propertied white men. And those are the tools that Congress picked up on when it decided to focus on immigrants, because they had Chinese immigrants arriving in large numbers.
Right.
And eventually that led to the national origins quotas, where we explicitly used racism to decide who could get a visa, a spot in this country. And Mexicans in particular were actually exempted in order for Southern businesses to use them for cheap labor. So instead of excluding them, that's why in the 1920s, Southern segregationists proposed criminalizing unlawful border crossings, so that when people's labor was no longer needed, they could be easily policed, imprisoned, and deported. Mm-hmm. And that's the legacy of our immigration laws. And while we may have gotten rid of the national origins quotas in 1965, we replaced it with a system that essentially capped immigration, including Mexican immigration, for the first time to 20,000 visas when hundreds of thousands of people had been going back and forth. And the laws created this kind of undocumented population. It created this false sense of illegality. And as a backlash to legal immigration suddenly coming from Asia and Africa, the Caribbean, you saw this rise of like law and order policies and the 1970s and 80s, the war on crime, the war on drugs, suddenly treating immigrants as criminals. And that's really what's laid the foundations for the modern immigration system today, where police have been taken over as essentially immigration agents to create a pipeline for deportation. And that replicates all of the racism that we see in policing generally, and it combines so that immigrant communities face this kind of double impact in their communities.
What a great explanation. Wow.
Well, it's one of those things where I have to say, with the election, what is giving me hope is you see this kind of new voting bloc, which I know you've talked about, of the children of immigrants, right, who have been living in communities in Arizona and Georgia and places across the country where they have been targeted by federal policies, by anti-immigrant state legislation, by racist sheriffs in their counties, right? And they've seen their parents be taken, and now they've grown up and they're voting and sending a message that, you know, we're sick and tired of our communities being terrorized by policing, that ICE is not welcome here. And they want to have that sense of actual security in their actual homeland, right?
It also means, do not use the term illegal to refer to a human being. Hello, mainstream news media. There are consequences. Do you understand what Alina has just explained? There's a reason why we shouldn't use that term.
Right.
And if you put it in a historical context, and thank you, Alina, for all of that.
Yeah.
You know, when the Pilgrims, the first undocumented immigrants, or to use a slur, the first illegal aliens to arrive on this country, when the Pilgrims arrived, they brought with them anti-Indigenous hatred, which then developed into anti-Black hatred, which follows to anti-immigrant, anti-Latino, anti-Asian hatred. It is all one thing. And what we have witnessed over the entirety of my lifetime, right, because I arrived in this country in 1962, is that, in fact, first we were like not really seen, like immigrants were like kind of there, we were kind of invisible, but all of a sudden now we are criminalized. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, remember, it used to be immigration, naturalization, service.
Yeah.
Right. It was a service, the INS. It's immigration, customs, enforcement, motherfuckers. You're not just an alien, but now you are illegal just because. And I wonder if you could talk about how the definition of what a criminal, to use that term, is in terms of the immigrant. And how this is being used to target more Black and brown immigrants.
Yeah, so it is clear that federal immigration agencies, politicians have basically been on a PR campaign of their own for decades.
Yeah.
Where anytime there is economic downturn, where there is concern, problems that people have in their everyday lives, and they turn to elected officials and they say, what are you going to do about this? Their go-to choice is to criminalize immigrants, to scapegoat them. Historically, I think one of the most prominent times the term criminal alien was used by an elected official was actually as part of, you know, President Hoover's State of the Union address in 1930, right? So you have the Great Depression, right? And what does he say in his speech, where so many people in this country are just facing the loss of all of their economic well-being? He talks about needing to get rid of criminal aliens, right? We see this coming up again and again, and agencies like Border Patrol, like even the INS back in the day, really chose their language carefully, where they said we should talk about the people that we're targeting as illegal, as criminal, in order to get more funding for what we're doing. And now we have an agency in the Homeland Security state that takes more funding than all other federal law enforcement agencies combined. To do what?
Right.
Okay, wait, stop.
This is a point.
In case people have forgotten,
dale rewind.
Let's just have Alina repeat what you just said. Un rewind. What did you just say, Alina?
The Department of Homeland Security takes more federal dollars than all other federal law enforcement agencies combined.
And within that, immigration and deportation and detention is like one of the central fund suckers, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, it is a $1 billion business at this point, aided and supported and run by the government, correct?
Yes. So you have the Immigration Customs Enforcement, you have Customs and Border Protection. These agencies within the Department of Homeland Security are taking in the most money. They're the ones that are soaking up the funding to do what? To terrorize communities that are part of the fabric of all of these districts that we're now looking at so carefully as part of electoral policies. Yeah. These are the communities that are under attack, right? And they feel it. Like back in 2014, during the Obama administration, my students and I worked with the Georgia Latino Alliance for Human Rights and other groups to actually sue the government to get data about ICE arrests in Georgia.
I remember that.
And what we found was that over a six-year period that included the first years of the Obama administration, their first term, nearly 48,000 U.S. citizen children in Georgia had a parent arrested by ICE, mm-hmm. right?
Wow.
And we're seeing that now. Like, yep. Those kids have grown up. Exactly. They know what it's like. And they were facing this not only because of the laws, right? So a lot of the laws on the books today are laws that were signed under the Clinton administration. They're seeing it because of policies that were rolled out by the Obama administration. And they experienced this because of anti-immigrant laws that the state legislature in Georgia passed, and then what sheriffs have done. And now that pain, that collective trauma, is coming back to bite anti-immigrant officials. Like we saw in this most recent election that the sheriffs in right. places like Gwinnett County and Cobb County in Georgia, they lost.
Yeah, that's huge. They lost. These people that were partnering with ICE, these young voters said, we ain't having it.
Terrorizing people in the state of Georgia. And now, let's see, what color is Georgia? Okay. So let's talk about the next 4 years in the Biden administration. Julio and I, as you know, have been watching this for a long time. What Biden has promised is to make the deferred action for childhood arrivals or the DACA program permanent, which I'm like, okay, as opposed to let's get rid of DACA and just do a full immigration reform naturalization. Mm-hmm. He said he would establish a task force focusing on reuniting children and parents separated at the border. And I'm kind of like, mm-hmm. la verdad? Mm. Un task force?
Just reunite the kids, right?
Like, no mames. Make a commitment that we will take all of the intelligence and make that happen. Okay, that's just me.
Right.
He also mentioned ending Trump's ban on immigration from 13 mostly majority Muslim countries. Our intrepid producer, Harsha Nahata, spoke with Make the Road Action organizer, Kendra Cornejo Munoz, who is based on Long Island in New York. And she talked about what this moment has meant to her and other organizers and what the organization Make the Road is going to continue to do in terms of a Biden presidency.
Even more than just reversing Trump's attacks on immigrants, we are working to secure a moratorium on deportations within the first 100 days of the new administration. And also, we need to see a humane immigration plan with a path to citizenship for all 11 million undocumented people in the U.S.
Period. Like, simple, I think.
Punto.
Alina, so what are you thinking about the Biden-Harris administration? What do you think needs to happen?
Well, you know, there's a line in my book, because I wrote this book during many of the years of the Trump administration, and I say that after Trump, we will be tested, mm-hmm. right? Like, some will be tempted to declare victory and just return to the olden days. But the reality is, the data shows that President Trump, you know, he did terrible things, particularly at the border,
yeah.
family separation, the Muslim ban, trying to end DACA. Those were horrific things. At the end of the day, President Obama deported twice as many people from the interior of the U.S. Yep. during his first 3 years than President Trump did, right? And, you know, I'm sure the data from this year will also reveal the same.
But Alina, just so we're clear, there's different ways of categorizing deportations.
Right.
The interior deportations are different than the deportations that are the immediate returns along the border.
Yes.
If you add those deportations along the border under the Trump administration's rule, is it still that Obama deported more people overall than Trump did?
Well, we're talking about interior enforcement. So when we talk about agencies like ICE, right. the knock at the door in, you know, the middle of the night, the roundups in communities in the U.S., there it's clear the Obama administration
right.
has the worst legacy of all presidencies.
Okay.
At the border, Trump has done more than just deporting and returning people. he has basically stopped
right.
migration at the border. He's gutted the asylum system. And those are real changes mm-hmm. that the Biden administration needs to tackle. And those are obviously priorities in the sense that people's lives are at stake. And so, you know, I don't by any means say that, you know, the Trump administration is somehow not responsible for ruining millions of people's lives. I think at the end of the day, though, what it does tell us that Biden has to do more than simply roll back the Trump policies.
Right.
What the Obama administration did was that they built up a vast deportation machine. They really did. And then they took those keys and they handed it over to Trump.
Yep.
It's not simply enough to say, well, okay, we can trust President-elect Biden to do the right thing. If he really wants to do the right thing, he has to actually dismantle the machinery. We can't have this kind of pipeline where people are swept into the deportation system because they get pulled over for a traffic stop. You know, we can't have the kind of mistrust of local policing. You know, local policing has a ton of problems in terms of how it has been terrorizing Black communities and Latino communities, just in terms of criminal law enforcement. There's a whole set of reforms that need to be focused on, and adding immigration to the mix only makes things worse. So that's what I'm saying, is that the Obama administration has taught us that it is not simply enough to have a person in power who believes that we should have immigration reform, who believes that the system is harmful. That person needs to act and actually use their executive power to dismantle the policies and programs that actually feed people into this deportation pipeline, instead of hoping that Congress will come in with a change. I mean, we have to push for that change legislatively. We have to push for reform. We have to get people on a path to citizenship.
Yeah.
But it's simply not enough. If we're trying to do that, that's a process. We can't keep funneling people into a deportation system and allowing families to be separated and lives to be torn apart in the hope that there's going to be legislative reform. That's the gamble that President Obama made, and he lost.
And the question here is like a central one in this historic moment, which is the word reform.
Exactly.
O sea, de verdad. I'm just going to say, I don't do a lot of policy Twitter stuff, but I did in mid-November. I did just go ahead and say, well, actually, the Department of Homeland Security and ICE need to be deconstructed. There's no reason that they have to continue to exist as they stand. And that's what you're talking about, Alina, in terms of being bold and being a leader. And this is what these voters want to see, Julio, no?
I think so. That's where there might be a misread in all this. And I agree with both of you. If this is just, hey, let's bring back the alumni of the Obama immigration, you know, we're still on the hamster wheel. And one of the examples that you write in the book, which has been underreported in a lot of ways, is how the Obama administration expanded the Secure Communities program, which the Bush administration started in 2008. And it was basically through these fingerprints, right, that were taken during local arrests. They were automatically shared with DHS, right? Homeland Security.
Dude, and a local arrest for, like, you know, having a beer, not in a bag.
Exactly. That would then trigger a review of immigration records. So we've talked about how Black and brown communities and immigrants in those communities live in places that are already over-policed. And so Kendra Cornejo Munoz, the organizer you heard previously in the show with Make the Road Action, she's working with youth ages 14 to 22 to build power across communities. And recently they've been focusing on organizing to get police out of schools. And this is what she shared with our producer, Harsha.
I support youth on Long Island and in Queens, both heavily immigrant communities, which is both beautiful and can also be scary when trying to protect all of these young Black and brown people of color. When I'm speaking to youth in our groups during our weekly meetings, some youth have shared how traumatized they were when they immigrated to this country and were detained by ICE, or their siblings were detained by ICE, right? And now every time that they see a police officer or see any person in uniform, that fear creeps up in their body, right? Because we know that when someone endures trauma, that trauma manifests in physical symptoms, So when they see police officers, they immediately feel that trauma all over again. When there are police officers in schools, again, that's not safe for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And so part of what we've been saying for a long time, your work is pointing to, Alina, is that in the immigration legal system, which is completely separate from the criminal system, we need to understand that. Mm. And there is a lot of confusion around immigration laws and policies. And this breeds areas for lawyers to basically take advantage of people. You know, if your lawyer is telling you, oh, just plead guilty to that, walking on the street with an open can of beer, and you're like, oh, okay. But then you don't realize that that's actually going to lead you to a possible deportation years later. Now, this changed in 2010 when the Supreme Court ruled in Padilla versus Kentucky that, quote, counsel must inform their client whether his or her plea carries a risk of deportation. Alina, you were in the Supreme Court the day that this case was decided. You know, it's wording, right? It's saying that counsel has to inform their client, if you plead guilty, it could lead to your deportation. Why was it so important for criminal defense lawyers to understand and counsel their clients on the immigration consequences of their convictions?
This was really a sea change for those of us who've been working with communities who've been over-policed for so long. I cannot tell you how many clients I've had, and I talk about some of these stories in the book, where they were told to take a plea. You know, they're terrified of being in jail. They want to get out. And often for things that do feel incredibly minor. I tell the story of one of my former clients, Michael, who as a young Black gay man was kicked out of his home. He's a green card holder, but he found himself homeless. He ends up getting picked up for things like shoplifting, for jumping a turnstile, not things that we consider to be grounds for exiling you from the only home you've known. And when he's facing these charges, his defense attorneys would tell him, hey, you know, you want to get out of jail, take the plea today and you'll be out of here.
Right.
And so, you know, for him, that all happened before Padilla. So he was never given the advice and then found himself facing the potential of deportation later on. Today, now, thanks to this decision, criminal defense attorneys do have to advise their clients of the immigration consequences. And that allows people to have a fighting chance to be able to make sure that if they are going to plead guilty to an offense, they consider a plea that will allow them to remain here in the United States. But it also points to the importance of really challenging
local policing,
because you only have as many options as you have. Once you get arrested and you're put into the criminal legal system, there's all sorts of factors that can force you into taking a plea to something.
Right, right.
And that's why I'm so glad that you brought up the Secure Communities program. It has proven itself to be the major factor for, again, this interior enforcement, deportations within the U.S. And it was a program that was, you know, piloted in the Bush administration, but it was really pushed nationwide by the Obama administration. And we know now several things that I think should make this a priority for dismantling under the Biden administration.
Right.
It was a major driver of deportations, or about 70 to 80% of deportations due to interior enforcement, people in the U.S. being picked up by ICE. We know that it disproportionately impacts Latinos, like 70% of undocumented people are either Mexican or Central American, but they're more targeted by Secure Communities. And we also know, because we've been living with this program for more than a decade, that it has no effect on crime rates. You know, Secure Communities was rolled out across the nation in increments, right? And so you see a lot of Southern communities signing up for the program, not because they had high crime rate, but because they had a pretty significant change in their Latino demographics. They sign up for this program.
Oh, we must sign up because there are all these Latinos showing up now.
Because they must be criminals.
Yeah. And it's clear that the people who end up getting deported, the only thing they have in common is that they've had contact with the police, not that they have a criminal record necessarily.
Right.
Or anything serious on their record. It's just that so many communities of color live in over-policed, under-resourced neighborhoods. Contact with the police is common. And because Secure Communities just takes your fingerprints, not what happens with the offense, but your fingerprints, and shares them with the Department of Homeland Security, it puts people into this pipeline. So I think in terms of demands, you know, we absolutely need a moratorium on deportations so that Biden has time to fix what needs to be fixed.
If it can be fixed.
But we need to end secure communities. Yeah. We need that program, including the fingerprint sharing, to end.
Yeah.
Because the Obama administration tried to tackle things on the tail end of saying, oh, we won't take people into custody.
Mm.
But if that data is shared, that's what puts a target on people's back.
That's it.
That's why people get picked up by ICE.
Let's move on to our final segment, La Última y Nos Vamos, or The Last One Before You Go.
We are on the other side of this election, looking at an end to the darkness of Darth Vader. Should I call him Trump or Darth Vader? I don't know.
You should call him Trump at least once.
Okay. A report from the Migration Policy Institute finds that this man has taken over 400 executive actions on immigration, from blocking asylum seekers to sending ICE officers into sanctuary cities, to increasing enforcement along the southern border, to, you know, taking the children away from people as a form of policy and punishment. All of this with his cohort by his side, the little Stephen Miller. As the country battles the coronavirus, used it as a guise to extend a near total ban on green cards and impose severe restrictions on temporary work visas, which means that we do not have an immigration, quote unquote, problem or issue because it's at zero. We have a human rights crisis. ICE was actively conducting raids during the pandemic as detention facilities were battling the virus.
Okay, so we wanted to call out a specific case that you mentioned in the book, that of Ravi Ragbir, who is the executive director of the New Sanctuary Coalition, which is a grassroots organization that empowers those navigating the immigration system. And if you're a fan of In the Thick, we have been following Ravi's story very closely. In January of 2018, as Ravi was appearing for a standard check-in with ICE, he was detained and he was told he was going to be deported. His arrest attracted national attention. 2 years ago, we had Ravi on the show, and here's how he described ICE's tactics.
This is about psychological warfare, to make people so scared and so terrified that they are not going to access the due process. And that is intentional. If you look at what ICE is doing right now, in the past, they would do these raids and they would do things and they would keep it on the down low. Now they are making it very, very public because they want to show that you cannot do anything about it.
Right.
When you take me away, it is about showing, even with the large community, look at Ravi. Ravi, nothing, no one can do anything. In fact, I want to be clear that when I am put on that plane, this fight will continue. So people who are hearing this, who are Latinos, who are undocumented, you need to stand up because every fight that we create, everyone that stands up is going to make it much more difficult for them to act.
Alina, you fought this case and you were able to stop Ravi's deportation for the time being. And through the Immigrant Rights Clinic at NYU, you're documenting cases like Ravi's where the Trump administration is using ICE to crack down on those who dissent. So this online database is called the Immigrant Rights Voices. You've logged in over 1,000 incidents where federal agencies are using police power to target activists and organizers with threats of detention, deportation, criminal prosecution, and surveillance. That just scares the shit out of me. Alina, just what is next for Ravi and for so many others who are being targeted for speaking up?
So it is clear, crystal clear, that the Trump administration has really weaponized immigration law to go after movements. It has attacked people like Ravi and like Jean Montreville, who's also with the New Sanctuary Coalition and who was deported, people like Claudia Rojas, women in sanctuary who have been speaking out. The Trump administration has gone after movement leaders because it wants to silence dissent. It wants to silence dissent in order to prevent movements from speaking their truth. And this is a huge problem because we have right now the opportunity to make a change. We're going to have a vigorous debate over the direction of immigration law and policy in this country, the possibility of legislative change. And if we don't protect our movement leaders, if we don't make sure that they are here in this country to participate in that debate, that those who were unlawfully and unconstitutionally deported, that they can't come back to this country and restore the importance of immigrant rights voices, then we can anticipate the way this debate is going to come out. It's the anti-immigrant rhetoric will survive if our pro-immigrant voices are silenced. And so for Ravi's case, we are hoping that, again, the Biden administration will take seriously the need to protect him, to protect all immigrants who are speaking out so that they aren't targeted for deportation, that they are protected, that their right to remain in this country, in their home, and to keep speaking out is protected. And we are hoping that the Biden administration will make moves to bring people back who've been wrongfully deported. It is chilling. And it's not only about the individuals who have faced this targeting. They've certainly borne the brunt of the harm of these policies. But it's also about our overall ability to understand what's happening. Like when you look at detention centers, you look at women who've been speaking out about the hysterectomies in Georgia.
Right.
You look at people talking about how they've been treated in detention with COVID spreading, these outbreaks, right? They've spoken out and then ICE deports them. I mean, that is an outrage, right? They are trying to keep the American public from understanding what's happening in the immigration system. And unless we make sure that immigrants can live here without fear that they could speak out, then there is no way we can have a rational discourse about how to handle the worst abuses in our immigration system. Mm. So part of the reason we documented these cases is that we want the public to know that we aren't going to be silenced. And in the words of the New Sanctuary Coalition, you can't deport a movement. Mm-hmm. People are here to stay. They're going to keep fighting. We're going to keep speaking out. And we need to stand with our leaders and with the movement to protect that right.
Alina Das, co-director of the NYU Immigrant Rights Clinic, author of the book, No Justice in the Shadows. Thank you so much for your work, for your vision, for your commitment, and for joining Julio and me on this episode of In the Thick.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
This episode was produced by our New York Women's Foundation Ignite fellow, Harsha Nahata. Remember, dear listener, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us because it really helps. Also, remember, you can listen to us on Pandora, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts on. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at InTheThickShow. Like us on Facebook. Tell everyone you know to listen. In the Thick is produced by Nicole Rothwell, Noor Saudi, and our New York Women's Foundation Ignite fellow, Harsha Nahata, with editorial support from Erica Dilday. Our audio engineers are Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and ZZK Records. We'll see you on our next episode, dear listener. Have a great day. Ciao.
Peace, everybody.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.